kid away, so you never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil, and you fry some garlic, and you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? Have a little bit of wine. Sugar. Delicious. And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, 'tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Jordan, yes, live here in the studio. We thought for a minute our guest might not have set her clock forward, but in fact she was just driving around searching for the station, so we do have a live show this evening, and we're going to get started in just a second. I just wanted to say a couple of things. First of all, you know, write to Lynn Woolsey, Mike Thompson, the president, whoever. We got to go back to how daylight savings was, what, 2 years ago? It screws things up on the front end. I love March and early April mornings in real time, getting up with the sun and all that. And it's like now, it's like by the time I wake up naturally, it's already late. And then it just, this extended daylight savings just completely screws up Halloween, especially for the little kids. It's time to go back. That said, it certainly did seem like spring today. I had a little live gopher inside my house, compliments of Poe the cat. It's no longer alive, but it's still in the house. But also I did something really, really fun. I drove through Two Rock, west of Petaluma, and it's just so gorgeous out there. But I drove to this really cool little ranch, Ranch Hags, where they raise and sell chickens. And I got my very first chick. She is a barred Cochin. Her name is Ophelia. She'll be living with 8 chicken sisters in Forestville. I have visitation rights, and I will be getting eggs. Anyway, it was just really fun. And the Ranch Hags is such a great place. They're going to be guests on Mouthful, possibly next week or the following week. And, you know, come spring, it's chicken time. And not just because somebody you know wants a little baby chicken for Easter, but because eggs in your backyard and having chickens is one of the most wonderful things you can do. So we will be talking more about that in a week or two. In the meantime, you know, there's a lot of information online. You might want to poke around if you really are interested, see what it takes to build a secure chicken coop and that sort of thing. It's really fun. And then instead of watching TV, you can just sit around and watch your chickens because they are endlessly delightful. Endlessly. You can even get a little tape recorder and make recordings of them. You can get as obsessive as you want. On that note, you probably weren't expecting to hear all that. It's Talara Mazzeo. Did I say that right?
Mazzeo, actually.
Mazzeo?
But really close, yep.
Mazzeo.
Yep.
Author of a new book, Backlane Wineries of Sonoma, also of The Widow Clicquot. I had wanted to get you here when you were visiting a couple bookstores for that, but it didn't work out. So this is perfect.
Yeah, and, it's great. Thanks
welcome.
For having me.
Sure. You live in Maine most of the time.
Most of the time. I'm living in exile from Sonoma at the moment. I lived here until April of just last year. So in Sonoma, actually in Pengrove.
I didn't realize you'd gone to Maine so recently.
Well, I've always been doing part-time in Maine because that's what my academic position is. So was there part of the year, and then my heart was out here, and most of the time I was out here too.
Yeah. So what do you do in Maine?
I'm an assistant professor of English at Colby College in the English department.
Mm-hmm. Your specialty is 18th century, if I remember
correctly. That's right, because I remember that your daughter is also
Yes, my daughter teaches at University of Southern Mississippi, 18th century.
Yes, specialist. That's right. So 18th century and Romanticism is what I do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So how did you go from that to writing books about Sonoma County wineries?
It's not really obvious, is it? Well, I had gone to graduate school at the University of Washington. Of course, they had great wines there. And the guy at the Thriftway grocery store gave me a hell of an education in wine when I was a grad student. And then my first academic job ended up being at Oregon State University in the Willamette Valley.
Oh,
and there
okay.
wasn't much to do besides drink Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
And then we moved out here. I was working in the 18th century and had loved champagne and really fallen in love with the widow Clicquot and wrote that book first. And that book really was in my period historically. Mm-hmm. So the widow Clicquot was a woman who lived end of the 18th and the 19th century during the Napoleonic period, which is what I did research on. Mm-hmm. And then that was sort of the beginning of my writing seriously about wine and food. And so when I had lived here, the Back Lane Wineries of Sonoma was the book that I really wished had existed because when I moved to Sonoma, I guess six years ago, it took me a good 6 months to get the courage up to pick up the phone and call and, you know, get off 101 and off Highway 12, basically. So started out by having one of those big, I can't remember the name of the author now, but, you know, the big red book on the Encyclopedia of California Wines, had one of those and started just annotating it. You know, really focusing on what were the small producers, people who were family-owned and really not corporate-owned, who had interesting histories in the valley, who were making small case productions. And then one day I sent off an email to an editor. I was reading the New York Review of Books, and the Little Book Room had published a series of guidebooks, things like The Bistros of Paris.
I've seen that one.
Yeah, cute books. And I always loved the New York Review of Books. I thought these were great books. And so I just sent off an email to the editor, and I said, hey, I'm living here in Sonoma County. There's this book that really should exist. What do you think? And she wrote back and said, sure, as long as you give me the Napa one, too.
So are you doing a Napa one?
So, I'm finishing the Napa one right now. So that was how it happened. It was really just a kind of process of
easy
discovery
thing.
Of the community.
Yeah. Have you come across Sky Vineyards yet?
No, I don't know them. Where are they out of?
Sky Vineyards, I believe they're across the county line in Napa. I thought of them when I saw this book. They probably wouldn't want to be included.
Well, this is one of the things. Some of them are so small that they just can't accommodate people.
And, you know, a few don't want to.
Yeah.
And that's what I brought this thing.
So it's a lot of tourism, unfortunately.
It's a lot of tourism.
It's a good thing, too, but it's also the hard part. You have to have some kind of tasting room facility. Yeah.
It's
kind of hard.
Sky Vineyards, this was sent to me. It's a story. It's an article that Bradley Gray wrote actually a couple years ago about Sky Vineyards. And the guy who owns it is Laurie. Laurie Olds. He does not have electricity. He lives in what is called a wiki-up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He makes his... This is the part I love the most. He makes Zinfandels.
Yeah.
But also has recently planted some Syrah. And I think he's been on his property for 30 years.
Wow.
He very rarely comes down. It's up Cavedale Road, which is in Sonoma.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it may actually... They say Mount Veeder.
Yeah.
And Mount Veeder is certainly Napa.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, he makes for the labels for his wine, he gets pencil erasers. And he carves scenes out of pencil erasers and uses them as for block prints on his labels.
Right. So hand printed. So really a work of art, the label themselves.
Yeah. And he gets all through harvest. He recently got a generator, but he likes to boast that he gets through an entire harvest using a maximum of 5 gallons of gas for the generator. So that, you know, and he is known to sometimes greet visitors with a shotgun. And it sounds like it's
I might not put him in
part of his shtick.
I can see that he might not appreciate that.
Yeah. You know, and he yells at photographers. He calls all photographers the paparazzi.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, That's a picture of how it used to be up here.
And there's actually the thing that I was amazed at working on the book was how much some of that tradition really survives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's tons and tons of commercial wineries, obviously. We all know who they are. And they're great. I mean, that's a whole different tourist experience. But what I was really amazed at discovering when I was researching the book was how many small family mm-hmm. wineries there are. People producing 100, 200 cases of mm-hmm. wine a year who don't distribute, you know, who, you know, often mostly have licenses to
yes,
have guests.
Most do.
And but don't keep a tasting room open
right.
because
yeah.
I mean, it's too expensive to staff it. So if you want to see that side of Sonoma or Napa, I was also really amazed. I was thinking that it was going to be much easier to do this book in Sonoma, and certainly didn't have any trouble finding, you know, wonderful family-owned and, you know, really kind of boutique places. Although boutique, I think, is a word even then they would resist. I mean, really, they're just the way it used to be. I mean, it's what Sonoma County was before it got glitzy. And I thought that was going to be hard in Napa as well, but it turns out in Napa there are tons and tons of really just small mom-and-pop kind of organizations that are making a couple hundred cases mm-hmm. and doing it really as a passion. Mm-hmm. So you can still see that part of the wine country. It's just not the part that's on the billboards going
sure.
up and down 101. That's
now,
the problem.
For your parameters of the book, did you include people, do you include people whom you can't visit?
I didn't include anyone you couldn't visit.
Mm-hmm.
I did include people who have really limited numbers of appointments,
mm-hmm.
and their tasting rooms are essentially their kitchen tables.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were willing to say, if somebody called us up and wanted to come and visit, we can accommodate that, then I included them. Some people can't do tastings. I mean, there's a, you know,
the licensing
issues.
Yeah.
They don't do tastings. They'll do vineyard tours, and if you want to buy a bottle, then fair enough. But a lot of people that, you know, some of the really small ones making 100 cases are just making one wine anyhow, and it's not really fair to ask somebody
if you only
to
have
open
100
a bottle
cases,
of wine.
I mean, how many bottles can you open
exactly
for the tourist
right.
who stops by?
So really the expectation is you're coming in, you're getting a winemaker's tour. You buy a bottle of wine, just as, I mean, that's the etiquette of it. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you happen to open that bottle of wine on a picnic table out back among friends, you know, then so be it. But
mm-hmm.
But so they're all people that were willing to talk to the public, even if they weren't able to do tastings and
mm-hmm.
willing to serve alcohol. And my other parameters were, I worked really hard to try to get people, I think I succeeded, who were really genuinely not corporate owned.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be more difficult than I thought it would be.
Yeah, it's surprising.
It really
you have to
is.
Dig.
You do, and you have
yeah.
to really say, what's your family story? Who are you?
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the appointments, and there's, you know, around 70 wineries in the book, and it was sometimes at least an hour of an appointment where we sat and talked, and sometimes I end up spending whole afternoons with people. And, you know, you got to hear their story and how they ended up making wine and, you know, what their story in Sonoma was. But so I really tried to get people who were not commercial,
yeah.
who had small case productions,
yeah.
and that you couldn't find on a big grocery store
yeah.
shelf.
It's like, you mean Jackson Family Wine? Is it really a little family winery?
No.
How about that?
And it turns out that, you know, I mean, KJ owns a lot of places I
All
didn't
the
realize they owned.
Matanzas
yeah.
Creek, La
exactly.
Cremas,
yeah.
Great
Stone
places,
Street. But... Yeah, not family owned.
Yeah.
Right.
That's and many of them did start out that way.
Yeah.
I mean,
Matanzas Creek was one of my favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I lived in Pengrove, it was my
yeah.
local. And
yeah.
I mean, they're great. I still love them. But yeah, they're not. They are corporate owned now. And what I really wanted was to do, I mean, I wanted two things when I did the
mm-hmm.
book. One was to do something that if you were interested in the slow food movement or interested
mm-hmm.
in really supporting sustainable agriculture in Sonoma or supporting family businesses in an increasingly corporate and, you know, sort of tourist-driven
mm-hmm.
economy, that you could do that. And then I also wanted to write a travel book that one of those small winemakers in Sonoma would pick up and look at it and say, yeah, she got it right.
Mm-hmm.
So it was as much a wine, I mean, it was a guide that I wrote for the winemakers as anything, you
mm-hmm.
know. It was really a community effort.
Mm-hmm.
That was the way that I went around doing the research, as I started with one winemaker and I said, who would you send me to?
Uh-huh.
And they were incredibly supportive and enthusiastic about turning me on to places that don't advertise. People, no advertising budget.
Yeah, a lot of
budget.
Them don't advertise. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a ton of fun.
Cool.
Thank you. trumpet vine grew in the kitchen window.
It's Michelle. It's Mouthful. My guest, Talar Matseo. I got it right.
You got it right.
Backlane Wineries of Sonoma, and also the Widow Clicquot. We're going to come back to Backlane Wineries of Sonoma in a few minutes, but I want to talk about the Widow Clicquot. What can you tell? First of all, tell us about the book, and then let's talk about her.
Sure. So one of the reviews, which I liked, had a great word for it. They called it an enobiography, and I thought that was a great description. So what it is partly a cultural history of Champagne and how Champagne transitions from being a regional wine in the end of the 18th century to becoming a global icon for luxury and celebration. And it's also a biography of a woman that I think is a pretty amazing lady who lived in the end of the 18th and throughout the 19th century. Her name was Barb Nicole Clicquot Ponsardon, and she's known as the Widow Clicquot or the Veuve Clicquot. So if your listeners know the sort of classic yellow label.
Yellow label.
The Clicquot. Yellow label, my favorite.
I have fond memories of many nights with that.
Moi aussi. And so that was really how the idea for the book started, was that I was living at, right before I moved to Sonoma, I had a job living in Wisconsin, and I tried really, really hard to like Wisconsin. It's like the Happy Cows, the California Happy Cows commercial. I could so relate to the cows. I wanted to get out of Wisconsin. And so I had some girlfriends, and we got to be friends largely because the Veuve Clicquot was our favorite champagne, and we would get together probably more often than I should admit and drink some. And I got a little obsessed with the history of the woman behind the label. And so the running joke became, who is, the Veuve Clicquot? And one day I said, this is a book I'm going to write someday. And I was really lucky. I had friends who said, don't wait, do it now. Mm-hmm. So that's really the history behind the story. But she was a really amazing woman. She's the first woman in history, really, to become what we would consider the CEO of an international commercial empire. So she's really the person who put women on the first rung of the corporate business ladder in the beginning of the 19th century. She also had some amazing technical innovations in the cellar. We can chat more about that if you want. But those technical innovations are really the reason that any of us can afford as expensive as it is a bottle of champagne.
Oh, interesting.
And of course, she went on to establish a legacy champagne company, one of the first women in the champagne to do it. Was part of that transition for champagne as a product. During the 30 years of her sort of fabulous success, champagne sales increased 1,000%. In France. So she's part of the reason that champagne represents what it does today. So it's a story of her life and,
So what happened to make her a widow? I mean, the detail. sort of know the broad stroke. What's
anything.
The detail?
So her husband dies. No. So her story is she's married in 1798. And the story is that her family were textile merchants. And next door was a family of other textile merchants who were the Clicquot family. And the Clicquot family had already been running a really small wine trade on the side, maybe 10,000 cases a year. And there's an arranged marriage. The two fathers in the textile industry marry Barb Nicole to the son, Francois Clicquot. And the idea was that she was going to be home, be a wife and mother, live an upper middle class, existence in the 19th century, and that he was going to run his father's textile industry. But it turned out that Francois had this passion for making champagne, and he said, "No, I really don't want to do wool and goods, Dad. I really want to run the grow the wine business." And his father tries to convince him not to do it. Finally, he does. It's a disaster completely. He dies in 1805, and the rumor was that he'd actually committed suicide in despair over
how
he ruined the family business. And there's another story that he also got typhoid, and we don't know which of those two is true.
So they'd only been married, 7 years?
7 years.
So she was pretty young.
She was young. She was 27 years old. She had an infant daughter. And the thing that was really amazing to me about her story is at that moment she convinces her father-in-law to let her take a crack at running the champagne business. And it doesn't make any sense because she has no business experience, no training at all. And he invests really on the order of about $1 million of capital in letting her try to run this business.
Now, I want to stop you right there to ask a question. if it hadn't gone that way, like for other people, other women who were widowed in similar circumstances at that time in France, what would have been a normal path for her? What would have happened to her?
Yeah, for a woman of her class, uh-huh. the expectation was that she would either get remarried okay. or raise her child. And it's funny.
Would she have been supported by the husband's family?
Right, exactly. Okay. And really the expectation was that she would not have any involvement mm-hmm. in the social sphere at all. For there were, it's kind of interesting I found during the research, now there was a tradition of working class women who were widowed in the wine industry. So on the books at Moët, which mm-hmm. later becomes Moët and Chandon, at Moët in the 18th century, about 15% of his winemakers were women. But they were really peasant class women, and mm-hmm. they were almost all widowed because widowed women were the only ones who were allowed to run their own financial affairs. So there was a tradition of the veuve in the wine industry, mm-hmm. but not upper middle class women at all. And I think actually Barbe Nicole, if you ever a cover of the Widow Clicquot has a photo of the widow, and she was. It's a really rude thing to say, but she was not a beautiful woman. Mm-hmm. And her sister was apparently a great beauty, but she was known as really not being at all beautiful. And I think if she'd been beautiful, she would have been pressured to remarry. We're looking at a picture here and giggling a little. It's not very nice of us at all, is it?
You would not call her attractive.
No, you really wouldn't. See, I was trying to be gracious about saying not beautiful, you know, the double.
And that is that's a gracious way to say it. But,
yeah.
But, you know, she's also a victim of the style, the fashion style of the day.
Yes.
She might have been somebody who allowed to dress
something
in
other than
way.
Pigtail curls. Yeah, those yeah. are not a good look. Sausage curls aren't good on anyone.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think that was part of the reason that she was able to do it, that there were no male heirs, and that if she had been beautiful, they would have really pressured her to remarry. And I think they thought, to put it really crassly, that she'd probably done about as well as she was going to do.
Oh, God.
So they let her run the business. She runs it. It's kind of a disaster for a while. And then there's a story of her great triumph in Russia. And the story of that is that she runs the business until about 1814. She's also losing money hand over fist.
So she's not at that point more successful than her husband.
No,
was.
Not at all.
But they're just letting her go. They have enough money to
let
that happen.
What the father-in-law says is he says, look, this is 1805, he says, if you are willing to do a four-year apprenticeship with somebody I choose and you still want to run the business after that, fine, fair enough. And so he sets her up to do an apprenticeship with a gentleman named Alexandre Fourneau. And there's no reason anybody would know Fourneau except that he founded the business that is now Taittinger's.
I thought
so
that was what you were going to say.
That's the yes. history there. And they do a four-year partnership that ends formally in 1810. And I don't think it's her fault that the business is a complete disaster. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's really out there scrapping. But this is the middle of the Napoleonic Wars and trying to, through closed port, export champagne, which can only at that point be shipped two times of the year in the spring and the fall mm-hmm. because glassware was really fragile. It broke under 50% less pressure than glass would break under today for mm-hmm. champagne. And things were getting confiscated and things explode in temperatures. And also the wine went ropey. There mm-hmm. were problems. She had problems with malolactic fermentation controlling it. And that meant that the wine subject to heat could turn to slime in the bottle. So, you know, somebody
Yum.
Would... Yes, you could get a bottle of, you know, your $100 champagne that was like gelatinous egg whites was what happened when it went off. So she was having all sorts of problems. And then finally, she takes the great gamble in 1814. And really, what happens is that's the year the Napoleonic Wars end. And it's one of those great coincidences that the Napoleonic Wars happened to end in the Champagne. So that spring, the Champagne is occupied by the Russians and the Prussians and the French troops all battling it out at the very end of the Napoleonic Empire. And it's that moment where everybody's celebrating the end of the war. And every victory they have, somebody says, let's have some more of that local sparkling wine,
sure.
right? That's really the moment that turns Champagne into this international kind of symbol. And what she realizes when the war is coming to a close is that the Russians love this sweeter wine that she's making because the champagne that she was making, most of us wouldn't recognize. It was incredibly sweet, had between 200 and 300 grams of residual sugar. Mm-hmm. And if you think about what that means, you know, a Sauterne, you know, a really sweet
yeah.
vintage of a
really
of,
sweet.
A, of an Ecam has 150. grams of residual sugar. So it's as much as twice as sweet as a Sauternes, and it was very mildly effervescent, had about half the atmospheres of pressure that modern champagne does.
No wonder it turned gelatinous.
Can you imagine?
It was like bar sugar.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you couldn't measure residual sugar until the 1830s. That technology didn't exist. So you were really taking a huge chance with, poor glassware and a lot of pressure in a bottle. It was pretty dangerous. Uh-huh. There were all sorts of stories of people working in the cellars losing their eyes.
Sure.
So anyhow, she takes this. She says, "Well, if I can get that wine to Russia, where they love my sweet champagne, before any of my competitors, when I'm the only champagne there, I bet I can capture this market." And so she illegally sends 10,000 bottles of her very best champagne, which was the 1811 vintage, which is one of the two great vintages of the 19th century, smuggles it to Russia. And if anybody else had done the same thing, she'd have been ruined. If it had been confiscated, she was done for. I mean, she was just on the brink of financial ruin. But instead, she gets it there, and within weeks of its arrival, she is fabulously successful. It's just, it's sort of a fad, really. The Tsar proclaims he won't drink anything else, and within the next 10 years, she has the biggest. Within a decade after that great success, she's one of the wealthiest women in Europe. So.
It's an amazing story.
It's an amazing story. She's a pretty feisty lady.
Yeah. So what were some of the innovations in the cellar that we can credit her with?
Yeah, she invented the process known as remuage, also known as riddling.
Riddling.
And so what? If you see it all the up in Healdsburg, you go and you see the riddling racks, right?
Iron Horse Vineyards, Sebastopol.
Exactly, one of my favorite local sparkling wine places, actually. Yeah. You can go and see those riddling racks, and it seems completely counterintuitive now, but the way that they used to do it before she invented the obvious process of turning the bottles upside down, right? You wouldn't have thought that would have taken centuries of innovation for some woman to figure that out. common sense in the cellars, right? Before that, they had a process known as transvasage, which was just what it suggests in France, which is pouring things from one bottle to another. So they would take their champagne. For anyone who's not really familiar with how champagne's made, right, you take a still wine, you pour in some extra yeast and sugar, you cap it, the fermentation starts again, more alcohol, the carbon dioxide gets trapped.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you got the problem with the dead yeast gunk in the bottom. So that's what we're talking about is, how to get rid of the...
How do you get rid of the dead yeast?
Because I don't know about you. I do not want gunks of yeast floating around in my champagne.
No. It's not pleasant. It interferes with the texture, for one thing.
It doesn't
thing.
Look good with our little black dresses, does
no,
it?
No, it does not.
Little black dresses, pearls, and gunk in our champagne?
Yes,
no, I don't think so.
If you're drinking champagne out of, paper cups, you might not notice... So much, but
if you're drinking your champagne out of paper cups, we have bigger problems in this world,
yes.
Right? So then you don't deserve to have your champagne. She invented the process of turning it upside down and then having somebody turn it. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing.
Give the bottle a quarter turn every day,
yeah. Right, for a couple of weeks. And then eventually you get this kind of mass of yeasty gunk in the neck. And then the idea would be that somebody would turn the bottle, open the cork, head to a super fast thumb, and as soon as the gunk was gone, you recorked
pops out.
It. Right.
Yeah.
And you put some more, liqueur d'expedition, the bottling liqueur in there, and you were done. So that was the technique that she invented. And really what that allowed was people to continue making champagne as a handcrafted artisanal product, but to speed up the production.
And to not lose all that you lose transferring from bottle to bottle.
Right.
You lose not just quantity.
But sparkle.
Sparkle, flavor.
Right. Exactly.
You're oxidizing all the time as you're transferring.
Yeah. Can you imagine? I mean, if we think about pouring even a glass of champagne from glass to glass a couple of times. I mean, you don't want to drink it afterwards.
No.
Yeah, it would ruin it.
Yeah.
So that was the process she invented. And that was part of the reason that also in the end of the, this moment where the Napoleonic Wars happened to be making champagne kind of on the cultural radar screen for the first time, she also invented something, within just a couple of years of that, that brought the prices down enough that it could be a mass commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great story about how she and Jean-Remy Moët had this incredibly complicated relationship where they're really arch rivals. And there are these not very nice letters where he says basically somebody has got to figure out how she is getting her wine so clear and she shouldn't be doing this. She's a woman. So, it was great.
I love stories like that.
I'll take the back roads home through the open countryside, letting things slip by in drawn out time. I'll take the long way home on the back roads of this life, taking time to see goes by. Coming and going, there's no dividing line. What you're headed for, someone left.
And it's Mouthful. That was fast for some reason. I thought we were going back to music. It's Mouthful. It's Michelle. It's KRCB. We are talking with Talar Matzeo. And we're going to be coming back to her new book, Back Lane, Wineries of Sonoma. But I'm just fascinated by the Widow Clicquot.
Yeah.
How long did she live?
She lived almost 90 years old. So she had a great story. She was born in 1777 and died in the 1860s. And there's a really interesting story about that yellow label.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things I thought was really fascinating writing The Widow Clicquot was the history of women in Champagne during the 19th century. Because there's another great woman of the Champagne in the 19th century who was the Widow Pommeret. And the story behind the yellow Veuve Clicquot label actually is the story of one of the few mistakes that the Veuve Clicquot made as a businesswoman. And that was that she had been making this sweeter champagne that the Russians liked so much. And she kept trying to sell the champagne in Britain, and nobody wanted it. And so she just decided that the Brits didn't like champagne.
Oh.
Which we all know is obviously wrong. And but she couldn't get them to bite on the market. Well, Louise Pommeret had been sent to boarding school in Britain. And she realized that the Brits did want champagne. It was just they didn't like it so sweet. So she invented brut champagne, or, champagne mm-hmm. with low residual sugar. And within a decade, this is in the 1860s, and within a decade of selling it, she had become also fabulously wealthy, mm-hmm. following in the footsteps, really, of the Veuve Clicquot. And so the Widow Clicquot at this point realizes, I might have miscalculated this. So the yellow label was meant to sell their first brut to the British market. So if you look at it still, it's the brut non-vintage that it still markets, that everyone thinks of as the classic Veuve Clicquot.
So was she able to get in there and compete in Britain?
She was, yeah. I mean, she died very, very soon after. So she dies in the 1860s. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting story. She had her business partner, this gentleman named Edward Varlet. He starts out as a clerk, a German clerk in her office. And the story is that she had a little bit of a crush on Edward, and that he moved up the ranks a bit more quickly than he
than
might otherwise have. And in the end, she sells him 50% of the business when she's ready to retire for a very, very low price, and essentially cuts her daughter and son-in-law out of the business.
I was going to ask what happened to her daughter.
Her daughter, she marries off to a feckless count. The story is that she also had the contemporary quote was that she was, quote, infatuated with her son-in-law, who, just because she was widowed at 27, come on, you
poor
know?
Thing.
She didn't get remarried, but that doesn't mean she didn't think, right? So she apparently had a thing for handsome young gentlemen. And there's a funny story about him. He was the Comte de Chevigny, the Count of Chevigny, and married off to her daughter, Clementine. And the story was that he liked to write risque poems, sort of, mild erotica.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought this was so embarrassing that every time he published a new print run of them, she would go buy it all up so that it never hit the market. But of course, then he thought he had a bestseller on his hands.
Uh-huh. And he'd write more.
He would write more. So for years and years, she's buying all of his dirty poems and throwing them away, and he thinks he's a best-selling author.
Life just doesn't seem as much fun anymore.
No, it doesn't.
You hear stories like that.
I know.
Well, that's really interesting. And so her daughter, did she just sort of cut them out of...
Yeah, I mean, they got the benefit of the inheritance, uh-huh. I mean, the business. I mean, they continued to get 50% of the profits from the mm-hmm. business, and obviously it went mm-hmm. on to be a legacy company, but they were cut out of any kind of day-to-day control uh-huh. when it was given over to the Verlet family and then later the DeVogue family. Mm-hmm. And then it wasn't until the last decade that it ceased to be family-owned. Today, Veuve Clicquot is owned by Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So now it's part of that luxury group.
Luxury line, yeah.
Yeah.
How did you start, how did you go about researching this initially? How did you dig into this story?
You know, I have to thank the folks up at the Public Library in Healdsburg.
Oh, the wine library, what a fabulous place.
The librarians were fabulous, and so did a lot of the early research up there, looking at especially 18th and 19th century travel narratives, because by the end of her life, at the end of the 19th century, by the 1860s, she was one of the great tourist destinations in France, mm-hmm. along with Moët and Pommeraye. And so there are very, very few firsthand records of her life. I mean, there's the archives in France, which I did go and visit. Veuve Clicquot did give me access to mm-hmm. the business records. But that's what they are, is business records.
Really? Clearly you read French.
I do read French, yes. Speak it imperfectly, but I stumble through, you know. Big smile, and the French are very, very lovely. But that was how a lot of it began, is mm-hmm. in Healdsburg, looking at, you know, old travel narratives and accounts of her life. And, you know, the series of biographies that did exist. There was a biography at the end of the 19th century was really the first biography written of her by, was commissioned by the company. And then the only other biography ever written of her was in the middle of the century, a kind of 47-page pamphlet written by the aristocratic wife of one of the presidents of the company. So mm-hmm. really both the things before that had been authorized by the company. And I was not, I mean, the company was wonderful about letting me have mm-hmm. access to those archives, but it was not in any way an authorized biography. Mm-hmm. So, but yes, kudos to the Sonoma County Public Library.
They're just such, the Healdsburg Library and Bo Simmons, it's just such a great resource.
They were
place.
Great. Yep, and there's also the one over in St. Helena, which is also, uh-huh. which I also worked at, and the people at Berkeley. I did a lot of the, you know, historical work down at UC Berkeley, uh-huh. and they were also fabulous.
Cool. How is she seen today in the wine world? Is she now acknowledged for the real tremendous contribution that she made?
Well, it's funny. I don't think in North America she's well known at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was one of the things that was really interesting, is everybody knows the label and the wine. I mean, it's one of the most recognizable sure. wines. But a lot of people don't even know that Veuve just means widow in French. Mm-hmm. But in France, it's quite a lot different. The details of her life aren't known, so there isn't a French biography either. But she has the status, really, of kind of an oral folk legend. Mm-hmm. So one of the people that I talked to when I was working on the book was Marie Giuliano, who wrote the book French Women Don't Get Fat, and she used to be the mm-hmm. CEO of Veuve Clicquot's North American brand. So she was one of the people I talked to. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that she had commented when we were talking, and you know, she writes that on the back cover of the book for me, is that Joan of Arc and the widow Clicquot were the two women heroes that growing up in France she knew. And it was amazing when I was doing the research because, I mean, it was difficult research to do because it meant finding really fleeting and passing references to her because there hadn't been a book where it was all collected. It was a lot of needle and haystack work. And sometimes I would just get completely out of patience with sitting there going through dusty French archives mm-hmm. and would just go and ask the vignerons, you know, the people working in the vineyards in France, and say, look, I'll buy you a glass of wine. What do you know about the widow Clicquot? Mm-hmm. And some of the most amazing experiences, I mean, not a lot of that makes it into the book because, of course, you know, there's only sure. so much folk legend that you can use. But if you know, I could sit there and talk with a room full of kind of working class French wine people and they could all tell me the outlines of her story. It was pretty amazing. And I don't know if that translates, you know, into Paris or beyond uh-huh. the Champagne, but in the Champagne region, uh-huh. you know, where babies are still baptized with champagne, uh-huh. right? I mean, she was absolutely, she's an oral folk legend.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Well, I think that's a great place to lead back to the Back Lane Wineries of Sonoma. Because one of the things, as a visitor to France, you know, one of the things I've always wondered, how do you find the little out-of-the-way wineries? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's real easy. I actually fell asleep on the train and I forget, is Reims north of Epernay?
That's right.
Okay.
It is north.
Well, I fell asleep. I didn't get off at Reims.
You got off at
Epernay. We fell asleep till Epernay, and it's like, okay.
I guess I'll go here.
Yeah, and we went, but it's the big places are just mm-hmm. so obvious and easy yeah. to go to, and I wasn't in France that time long enough to really find the yeah. back road places. And so in a way, that's how I look at your book for visitors who are coming here. It's like it's real easy to see the big places, you know, that advertise a lot, that have maybe billboards,
right.
that sort of thing. But then right. you go and you want to find yeah. the Williamson Wines, for example, on right. Matheson Street in Healdsburg. I'm just, you know,
yeah.
going through this Garden Creek Ranch yeah. Vineyard Winery in Geyserville.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, that was really, I mean, that's really well put. I think that's exactly the idea. That because my experience beginning wine tasting when I first moved to Sonoma County was that it's also just a lot less intimidating. I mean, you go to one of the big, we won't name any of them, they don't need any extra advertising, but you go to one of the big, you know, commercial wineries, and you can go in and you can be anonymous. And so if you're not quite sure of yourself or, you know, what you're going to think of the wine or, you know, especially if you're a passionate amateur and not a, mm-hmm. you know, not a trained wine expert, sometimes it's a little intimidating to think, I'm going to go and I'm going to sit down and I'm going to talk to a winemaker one-on-one for 2 hours. I don't
yeah,
think
that's
so.
A, yeah, that's actually a really good point.
And so what my idea in this book was to really go and to talk to these people, to interview them. Mm-hmm. I don't do, you know, ratings and points. Mm-hmm. It's not that kind of a focus. It's really, the idea was to give a, my joke is it's the J. Peterman of wine guides. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really narrative kind of scenic description of what is it like if you go see Bill Williamson or you go see, you know, Karen and her husband at Garden Creek. And, you know, what's it like when you drive down? What's their story? Who are they? So that you get a kind of comfort level that I think for a lot of people is what you need to kind of get up the gumption to pick up the phone and call and say, yeah, I'm going to spend 2 or 3 hours tasting your wines. Because that's really what most of those appointments end up being. I mean, I had a great experience when I was doing it. One of my favorites was with a gentleman named Jerry Pastorek, who runs Pastorek Vineyards up in Dry Creek. And if anyone ever wants to learn about terroir, it was a really wonderful experience because he makes a Cote Roti style wine, and he has two hills, one of them that has red soil and one of them that has brown soil. And it's the kind of thing where you can go up and, you know, during the harvest, you can take a grape from each hill and you can taste mm-hmm. the difference.
Taste the difference, yeah.
And so it's those kinds of really intimate mm-hmm. experiences, but you're, you know, you're talking to someone whose passion is making wine, who is sharing that with you for an hour, 2 hours, and you're sitting down and, you know, he makes just one wine and you're drinking it. And, you know, it's I think what's wonderful about wine tasting, you know, whether you do it in Sonoma or Napa or in France, mm-hmm. but it definitely takes a kind of commitment. I mean, you have to be willing to jump in with both feet.
Yeah, and it's not drinking wine. It's a whole different experience, what you're talking about. Yeah. We should say that not all of the wineries in here are obscure. There's a lot that mm-hmm. any reader from around here
right.
certainly will recognize.
Like Iron Horse. I mean,
Iron Horse,
well known.
Preston Vineyards,
yep.
good friends.
Right.
Raffinelli,
yep.
really well known. So
Pellegrini,
Dutton Goldfield,
yep.
Belletto. So a lot of places that have become really well known
yeah.
are actually still family owned, and that's
yeah.
so nice.
It is great.
It's great. And places like, one of the things I find, I mean, Preston is good friends to Mouthful, mm-hmm. and they're good friends.
Yeah. And a great experience. I mean,
great
what
experience.
A lot of fun.
But they've yeah. downsized. When you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Case production.
Yeah.
I think it was 7 years ago, maybe, when they went through a big transformation,
yep.
and they cut their case production mm-hmm. much, much lower. And you know, Lou Preston is much calmer and
right.
much happier
exactly.
these days.
Yeah,
it's
right.
it's really nice, and they have all the wonderful cats.
Yes, they do.
The whole
I
line
think
of yeah, you
the
mentioned them.
The
they have the whole line of six-toed
cats. Everyone has vineyard dogs.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, but vineyard cats.
Vineyard cats are the way forward.
You also include some restaurants. Tell mm-hmm. tell us about that and about how you chose.
Yeah, you know what I tried to choose for. I mean, I did mention places like Cyrus. I mean, places that are really great. I have a lot of friends who are chefs in the area mm-hmm. and who are big foodies. And you know, there's some places that you know are on the radar screen that are in Food and Wine that are well known. Places like you know Mirepoix. Café La Haye, mm-hmm. you know, all of those have a big presence on Yelp. Somewhere like Cyrus gets a great, you know, obviously gets great
tons
recognition.
Tons of
But I also try to include places that I think of really mm-hmm. as local secrets. So, you know, Mark Dirkhuizing's, mm-hmm. the Parkside.
Dirk's Parkside, yes.
And their purveyor dinners are mm-hmm. fabulous. Yeah. Chloe.
Chloe Cafe.
Yeah.
Little French place.
Right. That you'd have to really have spent some time, you know, in Sonoma. Mm-hmm. They're not the places that are obvious. Obviously signposted. Again, they don't have big billboards, but they're the kind of place that you go and that's where all of my friends go, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the, you know, people who are passionate about food in the community, the places they go. So that was really how I tried to balance it is, you know, just because somebody was well known, if they were, you know, also making great food, I didn't want to exclude them, but I really mm-hmm. wanted to make sure that you also got great places. Like, I include Santi just because the Healdsburg Farmers Market, you know.
Oh, yeah, and Santi.
Those sausages are so to die for.
You got to sit at the bar and have the
And they have the dinners.
Yeah,
they have you know, the dinners mm-hmm. where you can go in and have regional, you know, prefix menus, and it's great. But those sausages, I think, might be the best sausages mm-hmm. I've ever
They're
had
really
in
good.
My entire life.
Oh, yeah. They're really, yeah. really, really good. So what's next is... Is it the Napa book?
So right now I'm finishing up the mm-hmm. Backlane Wineries of Napa.
Any secrets you want to tell us about before publication?
Well, you know, I can tell you there are lots and lots of wonderful places I've discovered, but I wanted to mention one place that I recently discovered over that is on the Sonoma side of the line that I didn't include in Backlane Wineries of Sonoma that everybody should go and check out, which is the McLeod Vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
I had never discovered. I went and spent an afternoon with George not too long ago, and I mean, they are great for my money. They're, you know, an absolute dream bargain. Wonderful, wonderful wine.
Now, have you gotten York?
I haven't gotten York yet.
Let me think of his name. The Anchor Steam, the guy who
Fritz
Maytag, who actually has been a guest on Mouthful.
Yeah.
One of my. He's a very he comes from the Maytag
yeah.
cheese family. He's the one who renovated Anchor Steam and sort of launched the whole micro brew movement in the United States.
Yeah.
He is an extremely thoughtful, cerebral, mm-hmm. interesting, precise
right.
man. He has done something with musical instruments where he had a string quartet. And I don't know, Lawrence, if you ever heard the show. Interrupt me if I get this wrong. But it's like he had four instruments made out of the same tree or something like that, or by the same producer. It's very technically perfect producer. And these instruments, there's a cello, violin, viola, and a bass maybe, I'm not sure. And they go around the world. Every year they go to a student in need mm-hmm. somewhere, and that student gets to play them for a year. And then once a year they come back together, mm-hmm. and he commissions a show at Davies Hall in San Francisco. It was just I went
great.
To one of them. So he's a fascinating character. You have to get him.
Okay, I will go check him out.
You definitely
and
have to get him.
If folks out there, I should say, I'm finishing
email
up
address?
The Napa. My email address is my first name, Tilar, T-I-L-A-R. Period, and then my last name, MAZZEO, @gmail.com. And if people have favorite family owned, you know, I'm looking for definitely under 30,000 case production, but most people are under 10,000 case production mm-hmm. In Napa. I would love to hear people's suggestions. And then I also, I don't know if you do know my Napa secrets. I have an article coming out in the April Food and Wine issue about some of my research is over in Napa. And I don't know if you know about the Seha Family Vineyards has their free salsa lessons over in downtown.
Yes, I do. I've written about them.
You've written about them, too.
Just in my weekly column.
Yeah,
salsa lessons.
So I thought that was really fabulous. And then one of my favorite discoveries up there was, I don't know if you know, Heibel Ranch Vineyards. They are also a small, I think they only make 150 cases right now a year. They're great. Andrew Lane was another one of my favorites.
And then there's the one, I'm not going to think of the name right now, but they have a little tiny bed and breakfast at the place, and I think one of the rooms is in a treehouse or something like that.
I know who you mean. I'm forgetting the name right
now. It's
not
Holly, is it?
I don't think so.
It's Holly.
I don't think so.
I've written about
Holly's
them. I have
up
it
in Dry
yeah,
Creek.
That's here. I have a whole
because Paul Holly. I should
right,
say did
here.
The photos.
The
photos in the book are done by Paul Holly, who he and his brother and his mom and dad run Holly Wines up in the Dry Creek Valley. And he's done a great job with the photos, and he'd also had that movie that came out and premiered at the Sonoma Film Festival, Corked, 2 years ago, a year or two ago. So he did a great job. The early reviews of the book have really praised the photos a lot. He did a fabulous job. So,
well, you'll, if you come through, come back from Maine, or you're hanging out here and the book's out, come back on.
Love to. I hang out here as often as I can.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for taking time out on the first of the extended evening.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was really fun.
And I also want to say thank you to the Sebastopol Documentary Film Festival crew, and especially to the Sebastopol Center for the Arts. I hosted two of the films, and it's just such a great thing for Sebastopol, the Documentary Film Festival. So thanks for a great weekend, and looking forward to there being a third year and on. It is Mouthful. Be sure to tune in next week for another tasty episode of the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. I'm Michelle Jordan. Have a great week.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.